Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. And our artists this week are Richard and Cindy Lippert. Hi, Richard and Cindy.
Hey, how you doing, Gary and Beth?
For those of you watching the video, their heads are cut off, but when we get talking here, Beth and I are going to go away and you'll just be able to look at them. So, all right, this week has nothing to do with needlework other than we can all claim that we're artists in one form or another, and we all watch TV and movies. And so what we're going to do this week is a completely different thing. Richard and Cindy are longtime friends and second career actors. And what we're going to do is we're going to explore the SAG-AFTRA and writer's strike and try to get a better understanding of what's going on here, what the issues are, and how it impacts the actors. And the thing about Richard and Cindy is they are not movie stars in that they get the top billing. They're regular actors, like the bulk of the actors, the SAG-AFTRA membership. They're regular actors. So those are the people who are affected most, not Tom Cruise. He's not affected. But they are. And so we want to better understand them and all of this then, so we have a better understanding when our favorite shows don't show up in September on TV. Here's why. So we're just going to have a discussion here, a completely different thing, I realize, for Fiber Talk. But I know Beth and I are curious. We've learned an awful lot doing research, an awful lot. Holy smokes, this has been eye-opening. Yes. And so we just want to share that with the Fiber Talk listeners and get just some knowledge, because the 60-second clips on the news just are not getting it done. Now, just to kind of set the stage here, Richard sent me some numbers that help us better understand what we're dealing with when it comes to actors, SAG-AFTRA, and we're going to talk about acting, but we got to make sure that you keep the writers in mind too, because without the writers, Richard and Cindy and all of their colleagues don't have a thing to say. They're just faces on cameras with no words. So we have to keep in mind that the writers are in this thing too. Everybody's in this. And this really put it in perspective for me. The movie Babylon employed a total of 457 actors and 66 stunt performers. That's a 523 people, and less than five of them would be classified from Beth and my perspective, less than five of those 523 would be called movie stars. So we got 518 people acting and doing stunts in the movie Babylon who are all actors, all need to be paid, all need to have the benefits. Barbie, the hot one, 182 actors, 85 stunt performers, 277 total, less than five of them are what you would call movie stars. Oppenheimer, got to go see that movie. 128 actors, 15 stunt performers, 143 total, and again, less than five movie stars. So we're talking about these big number people. And it's pay, it's benefits. Yeah, those are issues, and we'll touch on those. But it's also the changing technology. It's streaming, it's AI, all of those things that are coming into play. And it really ties in with me. I just did an interview for the magazine I edit the other day with the president of a large automation company. And we were talking about the people aspect of manufacturing. And AI is a big player there. And our whole discussion was the people role, the role of people as digitalization takes over in manufacturing, and how critical it is that you still have to have people, and you have to involve people and engage people. And if they are not engaged in this technology, the whole thing fails. And I was thinking back on that and in this conversation, and it just kind of struck me, same thing. If you don't have the actors and the stunt performers and the writers, you can have all the technology in the world that you want, and it just doesn't matter. You got to have the people. And our conversation that I had with this president of the corporation was just that. They have to be an integral part. People have to be an integral part, or it fails. So with that lead-in, Richard and Cindy, give us your second career actors. So a little different from someone who leaves home from high school and heads to L.A. to become a star. Tell us how you got to this point, what you've done. I mean, you've actually moved from Phoenix so you could pursue these acting careers. So give us a little background on how you got to where you're at today.
Sure. I should love to. Thank you, Gary. But I want to jump on those numbers for one more thing to clarify. And just use Babylon, and it's representative of all the films, so it's not singling it out by any stretch. Of the 518 people on that film who were not, quote, movie stars, end of quote, those people worked on that movie for anything from as little as one day to quite a number probably worked a week, maybe two. Very few worked a lot more than that, and only a very few at the rarefied most pointy end of the cast list were in and around set for the entire 90-something days that it took to shoot that movie. So it isn't like those 518 actors worked for the 90 days and got paid for it. It's not unusual for an actor to go in a small part, do one scene, and be in and out of there in one day. And unless the character's somewhere else, they can't come back again. And that holds true on a series as well. If you're in a series and you appear in one episode of a series, you can't go back on that series unless they make your character that you portrayed come back. Also, on the numbers you quoted, to be clear, those numbers do not include background actors. You know, Oppenheimer, for example, in addition to the numbers you laid out, had over 400 background actors. And Babylon had to be way in excess of that.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So there's that.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that movie. There were a ton of people there. So then what you're saying then is if I'm a secondary actor, I don't know if that's the right term, or a background actor, I'm there for a half day or a day, and I get paid for that, and then I'm done.
Correct. So Yeah, exactly. You could be. If you're going to be there as a, if you're just in a small supporting actor role, you could come in and you'll work maybe one day, and you'll be paid for that day. And then unless there's a reason for that character to be somewhere else in the movie, you're done.
Yeah.
So, and the same thing on a series. On a series, it's even more critical because of the multiple episodes that occur. If you appear even as a background person and are recognizable in one episode, you cannot go back on that series.
Oh, okay.
Unless the character comes back.
Yeah. Okay, so that then to put that in perspective, then for those of us who work 9 to 5, 5 days a week, completely different, like opposite end of the spectrum in terms of employment, as an actor, then in that situation, you get paid for that time, and then you're done. Where
correct.
I work day after day, I get a salary, you know, 15th and 30th, I get a paycheck. Completely different setup.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So,
back to your original question, and thank you for indulging that answer. I personally had been around the industry pretty thoroughly when I was in L.A. a long time ago, in another career, and my neighbor at the time won the Academy Award for Ordinary People. Excuse me. And so it got me close to being in the industry. And so I was enthralled with it, but didn't do anything, went on and had a 40-some-odd-year career in business. During that time, I was also a race car driver, and I was a national champion. And when I decided to not pursue that anymore, and I found out that Cindy was not really interested in me doing the Red Bull Air Races, yeah, that was where the wide, hard line was. I learned quickly.
Cindy, you're so selfish. You're just truly selfish, Cindy.
So, I've had people say, how do you let him? And I said, where does the word let come in? Yeah. Where is that? Yeah.
So anyway, so I decided to go back. And you know, when I was racing, I'd got involved in doing a couple of programs of stunt and counterterrorism work. I said, well, maybe I'll go back and learn to stunt drive. So as anything else, being, you know, obsessive compulsive, I jumped into that. I went through all the stunt schools there were, and also went to rally racing school and drifting school and all those kind of schools. And I became an instructor with one of the two major stunt driving schools in the country. And my mentor there, in fact, was the gentleman that did the semi-truck flip over in Dark Knight, if you recall that.
Oh.
And if you saw Tenet recently, he's the guy that towed the 747 into the building. So, you know, pretty at the pointy end of the stunt community, and a wonderful guy, by the way. And so we would go out, and at the time I wasn't union, and so we would have web series and other shows would come out to us and want to either have us teaching their people how to stunt drive, you know, quote unquote teach, or just do some stuff in the background. And of course, the Jim or Harry would do it because they're union. So I would do all that work. And then it got to be more and more. There would be somebody in the car with me and a camera guy, which, by the way, the last thing you want to do is be the camera guy in the back seat of a car that's doing stunts. This is the word.
I should interject here, just so people understand. Dick is a former Air Force fighter pilot.
Navy.
I'm sorry. I knew I'd get that wrong. Oh no, it'll never be right again. But Navy fighter pilot. So fast and dangerous is kind of his makeup. Yeah.
So. But anyway, yeah.
I knew the job was dangerous yes. when I took it. Yeah,
for sure. So anyway, there was more and more times when I would have to, you know, have this person in the car with me, or I'd have to slide up to a spot and get out of the car and talk to the host. And I came home from a class one day, and I looked at Cindy and I said, you know, I'm just not as comfortable as I would like to be in front of the camera. So what would you think of taking an acting class? And then I'll turn it over to Cindy from there.
I thought it sounded like fun, like underwater basket weaving, you know, let's go take an acting class, you know. And I had burned out from church ministry as a senior minister. I'd co-founded a church, took over an existing congregation of 83 years, and I co-founded a seminary and was president of a 100-year-old organization, and you know, anything worth doing in our family is worth overdoing. So, so I completely crashed and burned in my own way. So when he said, "How would you like to take an acting class?" I thought, "Oh, that sounds great." And I thought, "Well, it'll be easy for me. I did two sermons every Sunday to large crowds, and you know, back to back, and you know." I won't have a problem. It'll be hard for him, but he doesn't understand how hard it is. And so he and I decided to take an improv class, because one of the reasons I burned out is my memory wasn't as good as it used to be. So I said, well, I just don't want to memorize scripts. So we signed up for this improv class. I sucked so bad. I was horrible. And by 3 months in this class, on the way home, we were talking about it, and I said, I just hate this class. The best part of the week is the drive home after class.
Oh.
And he says, oh my gosh, he said, I'm counting the days until it's time for class again. And So I quit for a few months, and I was miserable because I loved the culture. I loved being with creatives, and we were in a acting studio with kids, teenagers. And, you know, I loved how they surprised us, you know, doing improv with them, and they would refer to things that we had no idea what they were talking about. And so it really kept us on our toes. Anyway, long story, we ended up, I came back, we ended up down a rabbit hole that just, we both became passionate about it. And we spent, you know, 2 years studying the Meisner technique. I studied privately a play with with a fairly well-known comedian that wanted to learn acting. And so we worked on a play together for 3 years that we never put up. Just what I learned was incredible. First of all, anybody of a certain age, I'm 73. If you have trouble with, I know, anyway, he does, you know, he and I have different attitudes about age. I'm bragging about it. I survived, you know, I'm older than my parents both were. I'm grateful to still be around. The other thing is, I think it's important for us to tell our stories because we encourage people that think that their best days are behind them. And you still can learn new things. This is one of the most challenging things I've ever done. I was a young executive at age 35 in computer software business. And I began having cognitive problems at 38. So I got out of that, ended up getting into ministry as a Unity minister. And anyway, long story about me, but the thing is, acting helps you with your memory because the memorization, it helps you with your sleep. If you have trouble sleeping, just run lines in your mind and your mind will fight you. It'll make you go to sleep right away. The other thing is, it turns out learning to act is about finding truth. We create art with these human instruments. This is one of the most difficult art forms that's highly understood, highly underrated, and yet it's one of the most powerful non-medical modalities that helps people hurt a little less by distracting from our daily lives. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I really believe in what we're doing for a whole lot of reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We spent, I guess it was like a total of about 4 years with one school. We've worked with a number of private coaches over the years. We've done extensive, reading and studying and other classes with other, highly well-known industry professionals. So there's the adage of, if you're going to do it, as is said in the book, we put in each the 10,000 hours.
And
when you make a commitment, if you're going to do it, you have to make a commitment to it. You have to be serious about it and you have to believe in being an art. And one comment I think that leads into, there's a lot of public misunderstanding and anybody that listens, please understand we are talking today, as individuals, we're not speaking in any way on behalf of SAG-AFTRA, the WGA, or any other union. And so what we put forth is our opinions and our interpretation has nothing to do with what may be their position, and we would no way would want a conflict with that. So that being out of the way, you have a situation where, in the acting community, it's a very, very lonely job. There's no feedback in the job. It would be like applying for a job and you have no way of ever getting any feedback from anybody on how you did.
Yeah,
unless you get hired.
Let me give an example. Yeah. Since COVID, actors had to learn how to do their own auditions by what we call self-tape. Basically, you are recording yourself at home, wherever you can. And then you have to upload that, turn that in. There's a certain specification about what information they want and how you do that scene. You have to have a reader read with you, unless it's a monologue, of course. But the other thing about that is you are turning that in and you're never getting any feedback. For example, I had 50 auditions in 2022, and I did not book anything in 2022. If you can imagine the work that is required for the memorization, also the research and the preparation that we do, both in how we appear and present ourselves to give our particular take on that character, and then never hear anything back.
Yeah.
So the ego the ego, how can I say it? The maturing of your ego.
Yeah.
It's a steep learning curve.
There is so little little control that's involved in going through the process. You know, you don't without having any feedback, and then there's a lack of community because you're not working for a company. You're doing this alone. You're doing it at home, so there is no they that you can get together and talk about. You know, you're working for different people all the time. There is not, you know, you don't have a common office that you go to with people. So you're out there, you know, completely and totally alone, you know, at all times. The other thing is that in booking a job, it doesn't have anything to do with being a good actor or a bad actor. I said some degree, of course. But Cindy, for example, when she says her 50 auditions it didn't book, those auditions, you know, could be the fact that you're too tall for that particular role with who you're going to be in. If you're a female, and if you're particularly in network TV, if you're prettier than the lead, you're not going to get the job.
Yeah.
Okay. If you could be too old, you could be too short, they could be going for a different ethnicity in that role. Any number of factors can influence that have nothing to do with your actor, with your acting. We have a good friend who is a pretty high level Hollywood manager, and he points a thing. He says that the thing about acting is it isn't the best actor who gets the job; it's the right actor for that job.
And oftentimes, so you don't have. So when you say you don't have the feedback, that you don't even know if you were too tall.
No, you
just didn't get the job. So your ego, your mind is finding all kinds of faults with yourself when it just happened to be you were too tall. And if they would have said you're too tall, okay, fine. On to the next one.
Yeah. We have a good friend that was on a commercial, and she's an extremely talented young lady involved in motorcycles. And they had her on basically on hold without getting an industry vernacular. They put her on hold for, 5 weeks with her at that time?
Yeah.
5 weeks, and she ended up not getting the job because she's 5'3 or 5'2, and they put in a guy who's going to be the other person in the scene with her is 6'4.
Oh,
it's
Cindy, so she's on hold, and this is one of the issues in the strike is these self audition things. So she really can't go look for another gig, because it may conflict with the one that she's on hold for. So for 5 weeks, she's in complete limbo.
Correct.
Ouch.
For example, I had a recurring role in a series, and season two was being filmed. I was put on hold for over five weeks, and I couldn't you know, I continued to audition, but I was not available because I was on hold for a block of time that would it'd be about a month worth of dates.
Oh.
And during that time, and then I was released. So, and the reason, don't know.
Yeah.
They didn't bring that character back. Don't know why. Because decisions are made about the story. It could have to do with other factors, new people that they brought in. But the thing about, you know, especially women, and you've heard it said, there are fewer gigs, we call them, for female actors. That is absolutely true. He and I have noticed the ratio is about one to mine to five of his.
Wow.
Just in auditions that come in. It is, it's that stark. The other thing is hair. When I first started, I was so sensitive. Hair. When I got started, I had my hair in a real short pixie, and we were with Ford, and we did a lot of commercial modeling. It was great for that. But when we then transitioned into film and TV, it was very limiting. And I asked one of my agents, am I losing roles because of my hair? And she said, yes. So I grew my hair out and then I started getting cast. It can be that, simple. It could be that gray hair might be limiting, but it also might call for gray hair. So you can't go after and try to figure it out. You just have to be you and present what you have to offer. And that's your best hope. You know, you find your place, and if they're buying your look and your style and, you know, you.
One thing, a little point, but a comment I want to get in before I forget what it was, is that as I watch, I read a lot of postings in and around the strike. And recently there was a Wall Street Journal article and it has just under 600 comments on it. And I looked, probably glanced through about 100 of them. And within that 100, there was, you know, one or two that, and one of them was mine, that were positive. And the others were all negative. And it was just, you know, that the actors are overpaid and they're babies and there's this and there's that. And the reality is that the vast majority of actors do not become actors to become rich and famous and movie stars. They understand that that could happen, but that's not why they're there. They're there because they're artists and they want to be involved with good material and be able to tell stories through their role as bringing its characters to life and present them truthfully. That's why they want to do it. I mean, if it was about becoming, you know, rich and famous and a movie star, nobody would do theater. And the way it is, the theater doesn't pay. And so, but that's where it is. And so when they're looking at the world of actors to understand that this is not about being rich and famous and, you know, having a mansion in Malibu or that. It's the people, as any artist, as your normal clientele are, there's an art in what they do. And, you know, I'm sure many, many of them do it because they love to do it. They couldn't care less about ever selling any of their work, becoming famous for their work. And it's no different with an actor.
Yeah.
Basically, a career in, we'll call it the film industry. I've kind of divided it into three columns. The first one is learning the craft, the thing itself, how to act, how to do it, right? And the second part is the business of the business. And that's the thing that, you know, the average audience, of course, would know nothing about. And that is the websites, IMDb, the things that we have to keep up. We have to create a reel, which is, or we get to, I should say, which are little pieces of film from projects that we've done. It's like our resume. We have to keep up with our headshots. Headshots are accurate photographs of what we present, what we look like. And those have to be done. They're very expensive to go to the proper people because headshots are not just somebody taking a picture of you. It's an art form in itself. So there's a lot with the business of the business. But the third column is probably the one in our observation in the time that we've been in less than 10 years, is what I call the emotional maturity. And one of the advantages Richard and I have is that we have a full life of, you know, a long time marriage plus a resume of working and being business owners and all of that and just being in the world and traveling that the younger people don't have yet. So when we're looking for truth, it's easier for us to access either people we've known or situations we've been in. But that third one is the one that will derail a budding actor because they get discouraged. They're used to being patted on the head and told how good they are, especially if they've done a lot of theater and they're used to live audience giving them standing ovation like I got in ministry in front of a live crowd. And, you know, so you don't get that with film. Mm-hmm. It's just the energy of the set itself and the people mm-hmm. around you, but you really don't know mm-hmm. until it's all put together.
Yeah. Now you mentioned agents. Now in the movies, agents are forever fielding jobs. Obviously that isn't true. But yeah. No. I assume, I mean, you guys, I know, have had agents or probably mm-hmm. have agents. That's just a tool that may open doors or may not.
Yeah. There's two different categories that you run into. And, you know, if you're, and we're trying to talk to this about the, at the journeyman actor level, you know, if you're at the pointy end of the community, you know, if you're Brad Pitt or you're, you know, Tom Cruise, your relationship with your agent's going to be totally different than it is if you're at the journeyman level actor.
Yeah.
And your agent, the way the system works is a production company will have an idea for their story. They'll get the money to do it. They get it all laid out and then they need to hire a cast. So they will hire a casting director. The casting director will go through the script, break out all the characters, learn more about what it is, what they're looking for. Then they will break parts of the script down so that there's what they call sides, which are mini scripts for each actor to use for when they audition. They will then put out to all of the agents that they are casting for these particular roles, and here are the sides. The agents will then submit anybody within their shop that meets even remotely those criteria. And sometimes they'll throw in a ringer, and sometimes the ringers get through. I mean, meaning that they're way out of, you know, completely different.
Yeah.
Then the casting director will notify the agents of which of those people they will allow to audition. Then the agents will send those sides with the criteria for the audition, when it's due, how to submit it, all that information to the talent, who will then, in today's world, submit their tapes and, you know, and send in their tapes. So your agent at that point is really, you know, they have an agency, and the small agencies that deal with the journeyman actors don't have a book full of A-list people. So they're not living off their share of millions of dollars a year in residuals that are coming in. Now they're living much hand to mouth as the journeyman actors are. So they're going to submit as many people as they possibly can. And their first order of business is that they want their agency to get the job. Oh. And at that point, while they may like individuals, they really don't care who gets the job, you know, but they want their agency to get it. And the more right. you begin to book and the more you earn on behalf of the agency, will you get a little bit of a boost? Will you get a little bit of a help with the casting director? Yeah. So looping back, it's within our criteria is that we, of course, have to know our agents and have our representation, but we also have to work whenever there's an opportunity to meet casting directors so that they want to bring us in. Okay, so we have basically four agents. We have an agent in Los Angeles, we have an agent in New Mexico, we have an agent in Texas, and an agent in Atlanta, covering, you know, major markets.
Right.
We also have a manager who covers us nationally. Now, your manager is different. Your manager will actually go off, and it's their job to find you work, to help open okay. doors for you, to get you through to higher level casting director.
So the manager is your advocate. The agent is not your advocate. The agent is an advocate for their agency.
Technically, but your agent also is your advocate as much as possible.
Right. Okay. That's fair.
Yeah.
You don't want to undersell the agent, but that really isn't at the journeyman level where they're.
No, you know. They all work incredibly hard. The casting mm-hmm. director wants you to be the solution. They want you to submit, and they look at your tape, and they don't have to look at another tape mm-hmm. because you're it. Mm-hmm. So they're all rooting for us in their own way.
Yeah.
But our agents are the ones that the casting directors contact the agents. Mm-hmm. The managers are proactive in our behalf.
That's a better way to put it.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. All right, so I'm getting this picture of a whole bunch of people all on their own little islands, all trying to get themselves to a production and get a contract.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if we can help each other, fine. But we're all trying to get. Wow, that's a tough way to do stay employed.
It is. Yeah. There's a nasty word in Hollywood called frenemy. And he and I heard about it when we first started acting. We didn't understand what that was, but it's like we can be better friends if you're not in my demo. In other words, if we're not competing for the same role, we'll probably be better friends. Yeah. But hopefully the mature actor, and I don't mean that age-wise, I just mean emotionally mature, looks at each other as, hey, we're all in this together. You know, we may look similarly, but we are two different actors. Yeah. We provide two different solutions. Yeah.
Yeah. But the point about being there alone and doing those things, and what Cindy kind of alluded to earlier, is that having a sense of community and a place to get together and share really helps to, keep one's mental health going. So we formed, probably a year and a half ago now, maybe?
Yeah.
We formed our own, no name right now, but basically our own actor studio, where we have had people by invitation. We meet once a week, and those who can make it, make it. And we work on stuff, whether somebody has an audition, that's not going to be in conflict with three other people in the room. Working on a scene study, do some improv, work on monologues and talk and just open up, which has been a really healthy thing. And the people that come love it. And then everybody comes, whenever they can, life interferes. But one thing I wanted to build into this. Okay, go ahead.
Let me add to that. The reason that group has become important, and it doesn't take the place of a class, but what it is a hedge for the fact that classes are very expensive, very expensive, and actors are out of work right now. Mm-hmm. So it has become even more important for actors to gather together and just support each other. And that's what that is. It's a leaderless group. We don't want to give the impression that we're encouraging people against classes. Classes are important, but the reality is this: it takes a lot of money to be in this business where there is no guarantee of income, there is no guarantee of healthcare. You have to make, an actor has to make $26,000 a year in order to qualify for SAG's group health insurance. Richard and I do not know any actors that qualify for healthcare insurance, for a couple that are, I wouldn't call them A-list necessarily, but they are definitely, their faces when you see them. I'll put it that way. Yeah.
It's a hard number to hit, and one thing is, it also goes to what journeyman actors face, is that these people are not full-time actors. They can't afford to be.
Yeah,
and so they have to have survival jobs. Now, we're in a little different situation from the time we entered the industry. But so a lot of these people that are actors, percentage are smart people, and they're capable of holding any variety of jobs. But they can't take jobs if they're really serious about their career that are career jobs, because they have to have the flexibility.
Yeah,
we used to go in the room for auditions, and if you were in L.A., you might have a couple of auditions a day, and if you've spent any time in L.A., and if you live in Hollywood and you've got to go to Santa Monica at 3:00 in the afternoon, you're taking the whole afternoon off. That's the way it is.
Yeah,
and if you book a job, you're not going to work weekends. You're going to go in on whatever day of the week it is, or days of the week, or however, if you get lucky, how many weeks or even a month that you're going to have to go. So you see actors taking jobs that are below their career abilities. and it's a sacrifice they make to pursue their art. So that's why you see so many actors who are working in things like food service, you know, Uber's, other jobs, or as contractor under independent contractor status, so that they can have the flexibility because their craft takes the priority.
Yeah.
So it's a big sacrifice.
Hmm. Supposed to be all easy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it should just be fun. And if we probably had a brain between us, we would audition for community theater plays and have a little easier little time of it. At least, you get in front of an audience.
But overall, you know, she and I have done different things over our careers, not all of them easy. And we would agree that overall, this is the overall hardest job we've ever had.
Yeah. Talk about, the big two in this thing, other than salary and pay, which we can find those numbers anywhere, the small percentage of any major corporation, Disney or any of them, that would be required to meet the requests of the union is, that's, how many times have we seen that movie? But streaming and artificial intelligence, this whole AI thing, the first time I read, and Dick, Richard, you sent a couple of things about AI, where they can have an actor come in and record for a day, half a day, get their facial expressions, their voice and everything, and then AI would allow them to use that recording and make up characters is what I'm getting out of it for as long as they want. And of course, then that's a diminishing return, because the more bodies you get in initially, the fewer live actors you need down the road, because you already have a stable of recorded actors. I mean, to me, that's pay aside, that technology alone is frightening.
That's scary. Yeah, and if you watch Indiana Jones, the youth scenes in of Harrison Ford are AI. They're from other footage that he's had over the years, and they're able to apply. And if you look at it really close, you can see that it's not perfect yet.
Yeah.
But
Let's make that distinction, because there's technology called Lola. And Lola, you've been seeing without realizing it on newscasters, on news shows, but also in film. And what that is, it's like Photoshop for film. When you see your favorite star out on the street being caught in a interview or just paparazzi or something, you're kind of shocked that they look much older than they do in the film. That's Lola. Richard's talking about with the new Indiana Jones movie, they actually took old footage they had of him when he was younger. It's different from Lola. It's with the AI.
Yeah. And they can manipulate the mouth. They can do other things. Like, one of the things we all hate is joked about is when movies are dubbed, and because the words don't match the mouth.
Right.
With AI, they can fix that and make it match. So, it's a big deal. And you look in the background actors particularly, I mentioned on an Oppenheimer 400 background people. And I was on that movie. And if you got a bunch of AI images scanned in, how many do you really need to hire?
Right. Right.
And so it really can begin to work its way up from that level. So you got to watch how it affects background probably first before it moves up.
But from a studio perspective, the accountants, they look at that down the road. We may only have to hire a half dozen to a dozen live actors, and then just use our AI to fill in everything else. So the whole industry of actors and stunt actors, that's
Gary, I posted something on Facebook yesterday, and it's called generative AI. It is a picture of an influencer. I think she's Russian. She's got, I don't know how many thousands or millions of followers. She doesn't exist.
I saw that. I was just blown away by that. Yeah.
Completely. And I had some comments. Well, but this has gone on for years. Not like this. This is whole cloth. This isn't, you know, making Cindy and Richard look younger and thinner and whatever. This is whole cloth.
AI is frightening. There's an article today on The Futurist that talks about you can use AI to generate your girlfriend or boyfriend for perfect compatibility. You know, you can just create this, which is when you combine that with Meta and the ability to order food and everything else in and do telemedicine, it gets a little scary about how people might live in a few years. You know?
Yeah.
Right.
But
I'm going to stick with my wife, the live one. Yeah. I'm just going to go with that.
That's a smart move.
She'll be happy
smart
to hear
move,
that.
You should make sure she feels the same way.
Yeah, I'll ask her when we're done. Streaming is another one. Now, I've commented more than once just in this, you know, casual conversation about how actors must be loving the fact that there's so many more outlets than there used to be with, you know, with major studios and three TV channels. You know, with streaming, Netflix and Hulu and all the outlets, actors must love this because there's so many more jobs. And then now when this strike comes along and I start to do the research, I start to think maybe this isn't all that great because the streaming thing has got to be a real headache that everyone needs to sort out.
Well, here's the problem. And we didn't understand this because we didn't know any more about it than anybody else. And we've both been in some streaming series. But with streaming, there was no contract about how residuals would be handled. So there seemed to be more work. But what he and I started realizing, without mentioning names, we were auditioning and the parts were going to people, again, actors that you would immediately know their faces. You probably don't necessarily recognize their names. You might. But it's like, in what universe are the two of us auditioning for a co-star level, which is like, it used to be called five and under, five lines and less, but now it's more than that even. And that's a whole nother conundrum and issue. But same pay, but more language, more sides and memorization, all of it. But anyway, we started realizing because we would look up for after the fact that who got the part, right? Yeah. And in what universe are so-and-so and I auditioning for the same role? Come to find out, they are trying to make their $26,000 a year so they can hit their insurance. There's less than 2%. I think it's 10% of SAG actors that make enough money.
Streaming is a unique phenomenon. You know, then years ago, you know, when it was emerging, they kind of came and they came up with and rightfully can understand that, hey, we're a new business. We don't know where it's going. You need to work with us to see what we can afford to do. And we did. And people looked to the future. And this is going to take a number of years to develop. Yeah, that's okay. Well, and the pandemic compressed everything 10 years.
Yeah. You
know, just everything speeded up. And now it's gotten to the point where now it's out there and, you know, streaming is everywhere. You know, people are cutting the cord on cable, you know, left and right and going to streaming. But you take, you know, Netflix, you know, God love them, they're across the street from us, but but they're the gorilla, you know, and then there's a whole lot of lessers, you know, in the other streaming services. And I don't think it's unlike the airline industry in deregulation. Yeah. And all of a sudden these other companies are starting up. They're not making money. And so there's a lot of things I think that are broken about that model and that ultimately need to be fixed. You know, my personal opinion is, now, I don't think it makes logical sense that a a series should be 6 to 10 episodes. You know,
yeah.
It was originally 30 something, and then with more commercials, it went to like 24 that we saw for years and years on network television. You know, and then some significant amount of episodes when it went to cable. Now all of a sudden, so that means there's a lot higher cost, because with every new series, there's all the pre-production costs and all those things that, you know, once it's like tooling up for a factory, that once you start shooting, that you don't have those costs, and you spread them over all the episodes you have. When you have to start a new series, you have to do all that work over again, right?
Yeah. So
that's the cost. So there's something that needs to be changed in it. But fundamentally, you know, the actors are saying, look, we gave in initially. You know, now we're seeing, you know, you guys that run in streamers are making millions and millions and millions of dollars at the executive level, and you're cutting it out at the actor level.
Uh-huh.
Our job isn't any different, whether we work on a network show, a cable show, a movie, or a series. The work we do, the prep we do, is all the same.
Yeah.
And it's just that we are not getting the back-end remuneration for what we do. And, you know, if you talk about that, just to clarify, because it's another area where a lot of comments come in that are negative. If people talk about, well, I put together 757s and I only get a paycheck. You know, we hit this a little bit earlier. But if you have a situation where, somebody comes in and you pay somebody $200 to come in and fix your refrigerator, and you video them while they're doing that, and then you take that video and you're a streamer and you put it up on your YouTube channel or on your Instagram, and you start making money off of it, and you start reusing it. And if you're clever with AI, you start changing your image, and now you have them fixing your dishwasher and changing oil in your car and doing all this other stuff, and you're selling the image, and this poor person got $200.
Yeah.
You're making all this money. How is that fair? Because you're selling it over and over and over again. It's more like being an author selling the book over and over and over again.
So, right.
That's really what they're looking for on the residual side.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's a quagmire that's going to take some effort to get worked out, I'm sure. The streaming people are not going to give up that money if they don't have to.
No. Yeah. But it is the money that actors relied on to help support them between jobs.
Right. So,
yeah. And if you look at a show like Friends, where, you know, in the years after that show, when it went into syndication, they're making, $20 million a year off residuals.
Yeah.
Now you have shows like Orange is the New Black they resell it into streaming, and the people that run that show make nothing.
Oh. Yeah, that's tough to swallow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Now, see, it's interesting you mentioned Friends, because I remember when that that cast, the main cast, basically did a mini strike and said, we want X, mm-hmm. X per show. And, mm-hmm. you know, for the everyday worker, that's like, you know, how greedy can you be? Mm-hmm. And with all that you've shared with us, it becomes pretty clear. You put your stake in the ground and get your money now, because you may not see it again.
Right.
And you may not get another job again, and you ride that series to the hilt because it's putting a paycheck in your bank on a continuous basis. Wow.
You have to think of it in terms of art. It's really an art form.
Yeah.
And I've been a painter for a long time before I got into ministry. And if I were to sell that painting, I'd be paid for it.
Yeah.
If I created prints, I could sell it over and over and over and over. I could create t-shirts and all kinds of things. So it's more like that.
Yeah.
But it's why you're protected, though, because somebody can't buy your painting and then create t-shirts from it and resell your work without compensating you. Right.
That's right.
Right. And that's what the problem with the AI, I think, is with it's like they are taking you and saying, okay, well, we can make multiples of you, almost like cloning.
Right. It is
not
like
quite.
Cloning. It is like cloning. Mm-hmm. The other thing is the Hollywood doesn't garner a lot of sympathy. Mm-hmm. People think of actors and they refer to wacko Hollywood. You're looking at a handful of unfortunate people that have drug addiction and emotional problems and all kinds of stories that make tabloids a lot of money. And so that's what they think. But you never hear stories about Tom Hanks and his wife who are living quietly, or where right. Billy Bob Thornton is on his ranch in Montana or wherever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the majority of the really big actors, you know, live pretty quiet lives. You never really hear about them. But the other thing is, you know, you can look up how much does a SAG actor make in a day? What is considered just our base rate? And it sounds like a lot of money until you realize that you may work one day. Yeah. And that may be one day that maybe even a week, and the next gig isn't for a couple of years.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what I'm taking out of this and have learned right. just in getting ready for this is that very thing. Because you see that fee per day, and in my world, well, that's times five, times 30, right. times, you know, that's pretty good money. But when you learn that it was that day, that's it. It changes the game. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We have a friend that said to me, Cindy, do you get paid to act? I said, yeah. He said, very much? I said, yes. And he said, you just don't work very often. I said, right.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
He said, so starving artist is a thing? Yeah. I said, it's a thing. It's a thing.
It's a very, very tough job, you know, and I forget if it was who said it the other day. Somebody pointed out there's a thing called top of show, which is for what they'll pay for a guest star, and it's and it goes in Stratus working on a show. You have your co-star, which is typically should be the smallest parts. Then you have a guest star who's going to be a much more prominent role, and then it'll go into you can have a recurring co and a recurring guest on up to series regular, and then you know the lead. If you will, but when you're working down at the bottom in the guest star role, thing they call top of the show, which is the maximum amount that they'll pay. Okay, and so let's say you get a guest star role, and let's say that number for a guest star role in that episode, which is going to be encompass multiple days of work, might be $8,000.
Mm-hmm.
And you know it's hard. You audition and you don't book a lot of your auditions. You get a lot more no's than every yes. So let's say that you're a pretty lucky person. And you get three top of show guest stars a year, mm-hmm. which is pretty good. You're going to make $24,000 and you won't qualify for healthcare.
Ouch.
Well said. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's mm-hmm. it. If you were to tell an artist, mm-hmm. an actor, I can guarantee that you will have your healthcare. And that you can make enough money to rent a small apartment and keep gas in your car and some, you know, food.
Yeah.
They'd be thrilled. They'd be totally thrilled.
Yeah, fortunately, actors don't eat much.
Yeah, no, they don't eat at all. The first, just as an aside, the first party we went to at Ford, my husband said, we'll eat at the party. I said, there won't be food. And he said, well, yeah, it's a party. It's a Christmas party. I said, it's Ford.
Ford models.
They're models. They're not going to be eating. There won't be food.
And she was right.
I was right.
I did have a piece of cucumber, I think.
Yeah, cucumber.
I was going to say, gnaw on some celery. Yeah, have a good
yeah.
But all right, I think we'll end it right there. Boy, this has really been enlightening. Thanks, you guys. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Anytime. It's been great to connect this way. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and thanks to everyone for listening.
Thank you, Beth.
Thank you.